The following preview is of a graphic audio production rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
Available now in graphic audio.
How far you reckon we are from St. Louis?
I'll be there in another week just about, I'd say.
That arm of yours gonna be good and healed up by then?
It's pretty much healed now. I can use it without any trouble. Just aches a little every now and then.
Well, you best be careful with it. You want to be at full strength when we get there. Killing that bastard Beaumont ain't going to be easy.
No, but it sure is going to be satisfying.
Pony! Everybody, hunch cuff!
Hey, Dugan, don't you reckon it's about time you tell me what we're doing here?
Hear that?
Yeah, what is it?
Steamboat round the bend. What gets here? That's when the shooting starts.
Beaumont! I'm coming for you, Beaumont, you goddamn coward! I'm gonna skin you alive!
The First Mountain Man 16, Preacher's Fire. Available now in graphic audio.
And now, for our feature presentation. Graphic audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents William W. Johnstone's The Last Gunfighter. Narrated by Ken Jackson. With performances by James Konacek, Casey Platt, Eric Messner, Ren Casey, Terrence Aselford, Stephen Carpenter, Tim Carlin, Michael Glenn, Tony Nam, Dylan Lynch, James Lewis, Michael John Casey, Jonathan Watkins, Colleen Delaney, Sonny Lasky, Tom Simpson, David Coyne, Andy Clements, Lord Shelby, and Jeff Baker. The Last Gunfighter, number 18. Killing Ground.
What do you know? It's still there.
It was good to be home again, Frank Morgan thought, as he reined in at the top of a hill overlooking the mining settlement of Buckskin, Nevada. A mighty pretty place, nestled in those pine-covered foothills as it was, with majestic snow-capped mountains looming around it. And it struck Frank, as it always did at moments like this, how odd it was for him to be thinking of Buckskin as home. For so many years, he had been on the move, wandering from place to place with a natural restlessness that had helped earn him his nickname, the Drifter. Since he had settled down in Buckskin and accepted the job as town marshal, though, he had experienced a contentment unlike any he had known for quite a while. When circumstances took him away from the settlement, as they had recently when a dangerous job had sent him down to Arizona territory, he was always anxious to get back.
There it is. The famous Buckskin, Nevada. It doesn't appear to have changed much since our last visit.
Frank turned his head to look back at the buggy where his son, Conrad Browning, rode with his wife, Rebel. She was a beautiful blonde, a Western girl born and raised, and Frank thought that marrying her was just about the best thing that could have happened to Conrad. She wore a stylish, expensive traveling outfit at the moment, with a modish hat perched on her upswept blonde curls. But give her a chance, and she'd be in buckskins and jeans and a Stetson again, riding like the wind.
The big silver boom is over. The settlement should keep growing, but it'll be slower and steadier now. Instead of going from being a ghost town to busting at the seams practically overnight.
Especially since it has a famous town-taming marshal now.
Frank wasn't sure if there was a faint note of sarcasm in the words or not. For years, father and son had been estranged. Even after the death of Vivian Browning, Frank's first wife and Conrad's mother, Vivian had left part of her vast business holdings to Frank, making him one of the richest men in the West. Even though nobody would ever guess that from his well-worn range clothes and the even more well-worn Colt 45 that was holstered on his right hip. No, Frank Morgan was not a tycoon. He was a gunfighter. Some said the last real, true gunfighter in the West. For quite some time now, Frank had aspired to a life of peace. That was why he had decided to put aside his drifting ways and settle down in Buckskin. But the violence that had surrounded so much of his life kept trying to pull him back. Maybe it hadn't been a good idea to pin on a lawman's badge. Maybe as long as he wore it, there would always be some no-good son of a buck who needed killing. Maybe he would never know true peace, Frank sometimes thought during dark nights of the soul, until he was dead. Then he would have the peace of the grave. Frank tried to remind himself at times like that, that sometimes things could change. Just look at him and Conrad. His son had flat out hated him when they first got to know each other. It didn't help that Conrad had been raised by another man, his mother's second husband, and hadn't even known Frank until he was grown. But circumstances, namely their shared business interests, had led them to fight side by side on several occasions, and Conrad had developed a grudging respect for his father. Frank liked to think sometimes that Conrad was beginning to feel a little real affection for him. Time would tell about that.
Perhaps I should visit more often. Since the Crown Royal Mine started production again, though, I've had good men looking out for my interests, like Garrett Claiborne.
And like your father?
Yes, that's right.
A smile lit Frank's face as he heeled the horse into motion and started down the hill with Conrad and Rebel following in the buggy. Frank's features, tanned and weathered by years spent outdoors, were a little too rugged to be called handsome, but he was a man with a compelling, powerful presence anyway. Not a fancy man in any fashion. The revolver on his hip had plain walnut grips, and the Winchester rifle he carried in a saddle sheath had obviously seen plenty of use. As he rode toward Buckskin, Frank was glad to be back, but he was wary, too. The only reason Conrad and Rebel were here was that the situation in Buckskin was rather unsettled at the moment. Trouble might be brewing that could affect the interests of the Browning Mining Syndicate, Frank and Conrad, in other words. All Frank knew, and all Conrad knew, was that there was some question about the legitimacy of the ownership of one of the silver mines near Buckskin. At one time, during the settlement's first boom days, there had been dozens of mines around here. But then the veins of silver had seemed to play out, the mines had closed down, and Buckskin had almost dried up and blown away. Only a handful of stubborn folks had remained in the settlement, among them Thomas Tip Woodford, the owner of a busted mine called the Lucky Lizard. Then silver had been rediscovered, and with the advances in mining techniques that had been made since the first boom, three of the claims had become highly profitable again, including Woodford's Lucky Lizard and the Browning Mining Syndicate's Crown Royal. The third mine was the Alhambra, owned by Jessica Monroe, widow of Hamish Monroe. Jessica was an absentee owner, since some folks around here still held grudges because of all the gun trouble and bloodshed caused by her late husband. She had hired a competent superintendent to run the mine, and things had settled down again, for the time being, at least.
Easy now.
Frank pulled ahead of the buggy. His horse could make better time than the vehicle, which had to take the descent slow and careful-like. There was a road that the stagecoach from Carson City used, but it was narrow, twisting, and badly rutted in places. The slope leveled out into a meadow covered with grass that came fetlock high on the bay. Tiny flowers dotted the grass colorfully here and there. Altogether, it was much too pretty a picture to have death intrude on it. Or at least, it should have been.
Oh!
But it was at that moment Frank heard the wind rip of a bullet passing close by his head. He hauled back on the reins and yanked the horse into a tight turn. He saw that the buggy had just emerged from the trees and started across the meadow with Conrad at the reins. Frank sent the bay lunging in that direction.
Get back!
Conrad must have realized something was wrong, because the buggy suddenly slowed.
Cool!
The bay lurched at that same instant as a bullet smashed into its chest, and Frank immediately kicked his feet out of the stirrups. He was thrown forward over the horse's head and landed on the ground hard enough that he was shaken, but not stunned. Another slug plowed into the ground beside him. The bay had stopped thrashing around, so Frank scrambled toward the fallen horse. Its lifeless body was the only bit of cover available out here in the meadow. Frank was moving too rapidly for the bushwhacker to draw an accurate bead on him. He threw himself behind the horse corpse and hunkered as close to the ground as he could. Twisting his head, Frank saw that the buggy had vanished back into the thick pines on the hillside and was grateful for that. Conrad and Rebel ought to be safely out of the line of fire now. Frank risked a quick look. Powder smoke hung over a cluster of rocks at the base of the slope about 200 yards east of the place where the trail reached the meadow. He lunged up and reached for the Winchester that was still in its sheath, strapped to the saddle. He stretched out flat again. Frank thrust the Winchester's barrel over the horse and opened up. He directed his shots toward the rocks where the would-be killer was hidden. Several more shots sounded, but these came from the trees where the buggy had disappeared. Frank knew there was a rifle in the buggy, so Conrad must be taking a hand in this fight. Frank continued peppering the rocks with lead. This must have been more of a fight than the bushwhacker expected, because after a few minutes, during a lull in the firing, Frank heard a horse riding away from the direction of the rocks. When he risked a look, he saw dust haze rising into the air. Minutes dragged by. Frank waited with the patience of a man who knew his life might depend on it. The buggy didn't come out of the trees either, so Conrad and Rebel were playing it safe, as he had hoped. After about 10 minutes, Frank heard horses coming from the direction of Buckskin. He rose up enough to take a look and saw 4 men riding out from the settlement. Frank's keen eyes recognized the rangy buckskin-clad figure in the lead as Catamount Jack. Frank decided it was safe to stand up now. Jack and the others galloped up and reined their mounts to a halt. Frank looked at the 3 men who had accompanied Jack and recognized them as Amos Hillman, the owner of the livery stable, Henry Burton, the former professor from back east somewhere, and Vern Robeson, who worked for Amos as a hostler.
When I heard all the shooting from up here, I said to myself, Frank Morgan must be back in these parts. I surely did.
That wasn't a very friendly welcome. Downright hostile, in fact.
Yeah, that's the way things have been around here lately. Downright hostile, and getting hostiler all the time.
It's good to be back anyway.
You may not feel that way when you hear what's been going on.
Yeah, Frank, we got all kinds of trouble. You may want to turn around and ride the other way.
I doubt it. Help me get my saddle off this horse, and you can tell me all about it.
Hillman motioned for Vern to give Frank a hand.
Somebody's coming.
Frank glanced up and saw the buggy rolling out of the trees.
Don't worry, that's my son and daughter-in-law.
Conrad's back? He didn't seem too fond of the place last time he was here. You must have heard about Brighton.
Who's Brighton?
A fella named Dex Brighton. He showed up a while back and started telling folks that he's the real owner of the Lucky Lizard.
Hold on and wait for Conrad and Rebel to get here, so you'll only have to tell the story once.
I'd just as soon not have to tell it at all. But I reckon you'd better hear about it. If Brighton gets away with this thieving, he's liable to go after the other mines next.
Conrad brought the buggy to a halt.
Frank, are you all right?
Well, probably picked up a bruise or two when I hit the ground. But I'll be fine. How about the two of you?
Well, that varmint didn't even take any pot shots at us. Looked like it was you he was after, Frank.
Appeared that way to me, too. Conrad, did you let anybody here know that we were coming?
Not really.
What does that mean?
I sent a letter to Garrett Claiborne a couple of weeks ago, while you were still involved in that Ambush Valley business, advising him that we would be paying a visit to Buckskin once you returned. It's possible that he's received it by now.
Nah. I saw Claiborne just a couple of days ago, and he ain't said nothing to me about you being on the way back here yet, Frank. I reckon he would have if he knew. Could be, never got the letter.
But somebody else could have gotten his hands on it, and decided that he wanted to give me a hot lead welcome when I came back.
Makes sense. And I wouldn't put a little dry gulch in past that son of a bitch, Brighton. Begging your pardon, ma'am. I sometimes forget to watch my language.
Oh, it's easy to forget when you're talking about a son of a bitch. Don't worry, Jack. I heard a lot worse than that from my brothers every day when I was growing up.
All right, Jack. Tell us about Bratton.
Wait a minute. Do you mean to conduct a serious discussion out in the sun, right next to this dead horse?
It'd be a mite more pleasant in the Silver Baron, all right, Marshal.
All right. Let me just climb up in the back of the buggy.
Frank stepped into the vehicle, crouching in the area behind the seat. Conrad got the pair of horses moving again, and they set off for town, accompanied by Catamount Jack and Professor Burton. Amos Hillman and Vern Robeson remained behind to finish stripping the gear off the fallen bay. They would dispose of the horse's body later. A lot of people in the settlement had heard the shooting from the meadow, which was only about a half a mile away. Because of that, there were quite a few curious folks still on the street when the buggy and the two riders arrived. As they went past the hotel, Frank noticed a man standing on the building's front porch. A shoulder leaned casually against one of the posts holding up the awning. The man studied the newcomers with a cool but intent interest. He was well-dressed in a brown tweed suit, matching vest, and a dark brown Stetson. His face was tanned, in sharp contrast to the white hair under the hat. That hair color was premature, though, because Frank estimated that the man was no more than 35 years old. Conrad stopped the buggy at the hitch rack in front of the Silver Baron Saloon, which was owned by Tip Woodford. Frank made his way into the saloon and took a seat at a big table in the rear, along with Conrad, Rebel, and Catamount Jack. Johnny Collier, the head bartender, and the fellow who ran the Silver Baron for Tip Woodford, brought over a pitcher of beer and some mugs himself.
It's mighty good to have you back, Marshal. Buckskin just hasn't been the same without you.
Thanks, Johnny. Is Tip around?
Out at the mine, I reckon. Miss Diana, too.
Diana Woodford, Tip's daughter, kept the books and ran the mine office. Like Rebel, whom she actually resembled slightly in her blonde beauty, she was a bit of a tomboy, and she'd had quite a crush on Frank Morgan when he first came to Buckskin. Frank was old enough to be her father, though, and he had successfully deflected her interest to Garrett Claiborne, who was younger and a more appropriate beau for her. Johnny Collier poured beers for everybody, even Rebel, and then went back behind the bar.
All right, Jack. Tell us about Dex Bratton.
Fella rode into town about a month ago, not long after you left for Arizona territory, Frank. Nobody paid much attention to him at first. You know how it is. Folks come and go all the time. Brighton wasn't a miner or a cowhand or anything like that. You could tell by looking at him. I took him for a gambler, maybe, and sort of kept an eye on him for a day or two, just to make sure he wasn't a tinhorn who was going to try to set up a crooked game or anything like that. I reckon he was just getting the lay of the land, though, before he sprung his surprise. He went into Tip Woodford's office one day and told old Tip that he was the real owner of the Lucky Lizard.
That's not possible. Mr. Woodford has owned the Lucky Lizard claim for years, ever since the first silver boom in Buckskin.
Yeah, well, that ain't the way Brighton tells the story. You see, Tip Woodford bought that claim from a fella years ago, before there ever was a Lucky Lizard mine, before anybody had found any silver in these parts at all. Brighton says that his pa was partners with the hombre Tip bought the claim from, and that they had a deal so that they could only sell out to each other, not to anybody else. So according to Brighton, it weren't legal when Tip bought the claim, and since both of the original partners is dead, that means the Lucky Lizard belongs to him.
What did Tip do?
Well, I reckon he wanted to throw Brighton out on his ear, but Diana was there, so he didn't. He just told Brighton he figured he was mistaken about that and even offered to show him all the paperwork proving that Tip owned the mine. Brighton said that didn't mean anything, but he appreciated everything Tip did to get the mine operating, so he said he was willing to let Tip keep one quarter share for himself. He said he figured that was a mighty generous offer.
I'm guessing Tip didn't see it that way.
Not hardly. He got a little hot under the collar, finally, and told Brighton to go peddle his papers elsewhere. Brighton said he'd be sorry for that, and said when he took over, Tip wasn't going to get nothing. That's how things stand, as far as I know. Brighton's still hanging around town telling folks that he's the real owner of the Lucky Lizard, and there's not much Tip can do about that. Word is that Brighton's got some fancy lawyer coming in to take Tip to court and try to take the mine away from him that way. And another thing, Brighton's been seen talking to some hard-looking hombres, too, and Tip's a mite nervous. He thinks Brighton might try to take over the Lucky Lizard with hired guns if it comes to that.
It won't. Not if I have anything to say about it.
Well, maybe you can start now. Here comes Brighton.
Jack nodded toward the batwings at the saloon's entrance, which had just been pushed aside to let a man stroll in. Somehow, Frank wasn't surprised to see the hard-faced, white-haired gent from the hotel porch walking toward them. Dex Brighton came straight toward the table where Frank sat with Conrad, Rebel, and Catamount Jack.
You're not wearing a badge, but I assume you're the town marshal. Frank Morgan, right?
That's right.
I'm Dexter Brighton. It's good to meet you, Morgan. I've heard a lot about you.
I've heard a few things about you, too, Brighton.
I'm sure you have. Hello, Deputy. Don't believe everything you hear, Marshal.
I generally don't. I like to see things with my own eyes before I make up my mind about anything. Or anybody.
That's wise. I think you'll find that I'm just a man who wants what's rightfully his.
We'll see. My son, Conrad Browning, and his wife.
Mr. Brighton?
Conrad Browning of the Browning Mining Syndicate. Owner of the Crown Royal Mine. You see, I looked into the situation here in Buckskin before I ever came out here. I hope we'll be friendly competitors once I take over the Lucky Lizard. Enough silver to go around for everyone, eh?
Your business affairs are your own, Mr. Brighton. They have nothing to do with the Crown Royal or the Browning Mining Syndicate.
And, we'll have to see about that claim of yours on the Lucky Lizard. I haven't seen anything to indicate that it doesn't belong to Tip Woodford free and clear. Just the way it always has.
Not always. And as far as evidence goes, I have the partnership agreement between Jeremiah Fulton and my father, Chester Brighton. It clearly states that if either of them wanted to sell his share in the mining claim they own jointly, it could only be sold to the other partner. Fulton's sale of the claim to Woodford was in violation of that agreement. Therefore, the sale was null and void. The agreement also states that in the event of the death of one partner, his share would pass to the other partner. Fulton died first, so legally the entire claim went to my father. And when he died, it passed on to me. It's just that cut and dry, gentlemen.
You talk like a lawyer.
No, I'm a businessman, not an attorney. But I have had some excellent legal advice on this matter.
Where's that partnership agreement you mentioned? You're going to have to produce it if you want to convince me or anybody else that you're telling the truth about your claim on the Lucky Lizard.
In due time, Marshal. When the time is right.
And when is that going
to
be?
I believe a circuit court judge is due to arrive here in another week or so on his usual rounds. My attorney should be here by then, too.
I reckon we'll let the court settle it then. In the meantime, there's no need for you to be stirring up trouble around town.
What have I done to stir up trouble?
I hear you've been talking to some hard cases. Hired guns, maybe. In case this legal challenge of yours doesn't work out and you try to take over Tip's claim by force.
That's scandalous talk, Marshal. I haven't broken any laws, then I don't appreciate being treated as if I have. And I think it's obvious, too, that you're not going to be impartial in this matter since you and Woodford are friends. He is the one who hired you for your job here, isn't he?
That doesn't have anything to do with me warning you not to cause trouble.
Oh, doesn't it? Before you pinned on the badge here, you were nothing but a cheap drifting gunman. Isn't that right, Morgan? It seems to me that if anyone's got a hired killer on his side, it's Woodford, not me.
Why, you slick, no-good polecat! You can't talk that way about Frank Morgan!
Jack started toward Brighton, his hands balling into knobby-knuckled fists. Frank moved quickly to get between Brighton and his deputy before Jack could throw a punch.
Take it easy, Jack. That won't do any good. I think you better move along, mister.
As far as I know, Marshal, this is a public place. And you don't have any right to order me out unless I'm causing a disturbance.
You're causing a disturbance, all right? You're making me mad as hell, you damn tinhorn!
He's right, Jack. He hasn't broken any laws, so I guess he's got a right to be here. Why don't you go on back over to the office, and I'll see you later.
All right. But watch yourself, Marshal. This fella's like a snake, all coiled up and just waiting. You never know when he's gonna strike.
Don't worry. I've stomped plenty of snakes in my time.
Brighton stiffened at that, but he didn't say or do anything. Still glaring darkly, Catamount Jack stalked out of the saloon, sort of like his namesake.
Well, Marshal, this has been a very informative conversation. I knew that your deputy didn't like me, and now I see that I have to regard you as an adversary, too, because of your connection to Woodford.
I'm sworn to uphold the law, Brighton. If the circuit judge supports your claim, he'll have no trouble from me, regardless of what I might think of you personally.
Oh, I hope that's true, Marshal. I think you'll see in time that we don't have to be enemies. Ma'am, it was an honor and a pleasure to make your acquaintance. I apologize for any discomfort or embarrassment I might have caused you.
Don't worry about it, Mr. Brighton. I'm not uncomfortable or embarrassed. You see, I've stomped a few snakes in my time, too.
I'll bet you have, ma'am. Gentlemen?
Frank waited until Dex was gone before he sat.
I don't like that hombre. He's got some of the coldest eyes I've ever seen.
But he certainly acts like a man with the law on his side. He seems confident of winning his case once the judge arrives.
Yeah, but if that's true, why show up ahead of time like he did? Why not come into town with his lawyer just before the judge gets here?
That's a good question. Really, though, it's none of our business.
None of your business, maybe. I gotta keep the peace here.
There's no law against what he's done so far.
You almost sound like you're on his side.
Not at all. I don't like the man either. But perhaps I'm more accustomed to dealing with his sort than either of you are. I've done business with plenty of men that I didn't necessarily like or even trust.
You won't be doing any business with him. At least I hope not.
I don't see any reason why I would be. If his claim has no legal standing and is thrown out of court, then he's a non-entity as far as we're concerned. If it's upheld, then, as he said, he's a competitor. Either way, he's got nothing to do with the Browning Mining Syndicate or the Crown Royal. Which is a great relief, because it means that we can go ahead and get out of here and go home to Boston.
So soon?
We've been out here for 2 months. Isn't that long enough?
I wouldn't mind staying out here for good.
Reckon I'll go on over to the office and see if there's any paperwork I need to catch up on. I knew I could trust Jack to keep the peace around here while I was gone, but he's not much on reading and writing.
We'll see you later. We'll be staying at the hotel tonight. Perhaps you'd like to join us in the dining room for dinner.
Sure. I'll see you there. Oh, how much I owe you, Johnny?
Nothing doing, Marshal. Your money's no good here.
Claude Langley, the dapper, goateed Virginian who ran the undertaking parlor, walked up to the bar.
Things just haven't been the same around here with you gone, Marshal.
Not as many bodies to bury, huh?
Well, that's not exactly the way I meant it. But now that you mention it, and I mean no offense, Marshal.
I know you don't, Claude. I'll see you around.
As Frank stepped out onto the boardwalk, he looked around and saw a man running toward him. Frank recognized him as Vern Robeson, who worked at Amos Hillman's livery stable.
Marshal, you better come quick! Tip Woodford's about to kill that Brighton fella!
Take it easy. Catch your breath and tell me what's going on.
Me and Amos just got back. I was running down to the Marshal's office to fetch you. Lucky I ran into you, I guess.
What about Tip Woodford and Brighton?
Oh, yeah. They're down at the Lucky Lizard office. I heard Tip say he was going to shoot Brighton if he didn't get out of there.
Go get Jack and tell him to hurry on down there.
Sure thing, Marshal.
It wasn't that far to the Lucky Lizard office, and when Frank got there, he saw that the confrontation had spilled out of the building and into the street. Tip Woodford stood on the sidewalk, an old-fashioned cap-and-ball revolver in his hand. Red-faced with anger, he brandished the heavy gun as Brighton stood a few yards away in the street. Thomas Tip Woodford looked more like a miner than a mine owner. He had graying red hair, and his blocky body was clad in overalls, a slouch hat, and work boots, the same sort of outfit he had worn when he was still a penniless prospector. He had made a fortune, lost it, then made another one, and stayed pretty much the same throughout.
Pa, don't!
His daughter, Diana, clung to his left arm. Tip shrugged her off and jabbed the old revolver's barrel toward Brighton.
I'm sick and tired of you, mister. You come around here bothering us, give me that line of bull you've been spouting, and I'll blow a hole in you. I swear I will.
Tip, it's Frank Morgan. Put that gun down before you hurt somebody.
You heard you were back in town, Frank. Good to see you.
It's good to be back. At least it was until you started threatening to ventilate folks.
This thieving varmint don't qualify as folks. He's like a hydrophobia skunk that you got to shoot before it gets in your chicken house.
You heard the man, Marshal. He's threatened my life. I want you to arrest him.
There's no need for that. Tip's not gonna hurt anybody. He's just mad, and he's going to put the gun down. Do it now, Tip.
Please, Pa. It's not going to help anything if you shoot that fella. Then you'll just go to prison for murder.
Or the gallows.
You're not helping matters, Brighton.
Frank moved forward, holding his hand out toward Woodford, palm down, making gentle motions toward the ground. The mayor didn't lower the gun, though, until Frank eased between him and Brighton.
Dadgummit, Frank. You've been gone. You don't know what this varmint's been up to.
I heard quite a bit about it already. Why don't you give me that hog leg, and we'll go into the office and talk about it.
Woodford hesitated, then finally shrugged and placed the cap and ball in Frank's hand.
Aren't you going to arrest him, Marshal? I'll swear out a formal complaint.
Back east, you might get away with that, Brighton, but not here. No harm's been done, so move along. Anyway, you shouldn't have come down here and provoked the situation. I want you to steer clear of the Lucky Lizard office from now on.
You're a poor excuse for a lawman, taking sides this way, Morgan. Maybe I should get in touch with the authorities in Carson City and request that a U.S. Marshal be sent down here to restore some real law and order.
You go right ahead and do that if you want to, mister. You just go right ahead.
You'll never get your hands on the Lucky Lizard with your legal trickery, Bratton. That mine belongs to me, fair and square. Jeremiah Fulton had every right to sell it to me. He never even said anything about having a partner.
Of course he didn't. He knew he was swindling you. But this will all come out in court. You're a fool, Woodford. You could have had a quarter share in the mine, strictly out of the goodness of my heart. But now I'm going to take all of it away from you. Every last penny. You and your daughter will be left with nothing, you pathetic old oaf.
Tip's face flushed a dark brick red, and he lunged at Brighton and smashed a blow into the Easterner's jaw. The punch rocked him back a step, but he didn't go down. As he caught his balance, he struck back, hammering a left into the mayor's midsection and then chopping a sledging right across his face.
Pa!
As Woodford sagged to one knee, Brighton closed in on him, drawing back a leg to kick him in the face. Frank grabbed Brighton's shoulder and shoved him to the ground instead.
That's enough, blast it!
You saw it, Marshal. If pointing a gun at me wasn't enough, now he's physically attacked me. If you're a real lawman and not just Woodford's lapdog, you have to arrest him!
Unfortunately, Brighton was right. Tip had crossed the line, and the crowd that had gathered around to watch the angry confrontation had seen the whole thing. Tip hadn't left him with any choice. Stepping over to the mayor, who was still on one knee, Frank reached down and took hold of his arm.
Come on, Tip.
You arresting me? Frank? Me?
You shouldn't have taken a poke at Brighton. That's assault and disturbing the peace.
He's the one who disturbed the peace of this town.
Frank, you can't do this.
The law says I have to.
It's all right, Frank. We hired you to be the marshal and enforce the law, and I reckon that's what you gotta do, whether any of us like it or not.
And I sure don't.
Are you taking him to jail?
That's right.
And I assume you'll let him go as soon as you get there. This is all for show, isn't it?
Nope. Mayor Woodford will be treated like any other prisoner. He'll stay in jail until he posts bail. Then his case will be heard by the circuit judge when the judge holds court here.
Who's going to set the amount of the bail?
Well, as a mayor, I generally do that. Reckon this time it'll be up to the marshal.
You usually set bail at $20 for offenses like this, Mayor. So to make sure there aren't any complaints about favoritism, I'm going to set the bail at $50 for you.
That's a joke. He can pay that without any trouble.
I've more than doubled the usual bail. If that's not enough to satisfy you, Brighton, then you can take it up with the judge when he gets here.
Don't think for a second that I won't.
Come on, Tip.
Get the bail money from the office and bring it over later, honey. No need to get in any hurry about doing it, though. I don't mind sitting in jail for a while. It's been a long time since I've been behind bars.
Frank led the mayor away.
That was a damn fool stunt, Tip. He didn't leave me any option except to arrest you.
Doggone it, I know that, Frank. And I'm sorry I put you in that spot. That brat and the hombre just makes me so mad I can't see straight. I reckon I went plumb loco.
Can't say as I blame you. Fella waltzes in here and tries to take away what you worked years for. That's enough to make anybody loco. Problem is, he may have the law on his side.
I don't believe it for a minute. Bratton's crooked. You can tell it just by looking at it.
What in blazes is going on here? Frank, it looks like you're arresting the mayor.
That's what I'm doing. Tip got into a ruckus with Brighton. He threw the first punch.
It was a good one, too. Felt it all the way up to my shoulder.
I sent Vern Robeson to fetch you. How come you're just showing up now, Jack?
I was, indisposed, if you know what I mean. Sorry, Marshal.
That's all right. Happens to the best of us.
They reached the building and went inside. Frank waved toward the old sofa that sat against the front wall.
Might as well have a seat while we're waiting for Diana, Tip. I don't think there's any need to put you in a cell.
No, I want you to lock me up, just like you would anybody else. Bratton's already got it in for you, too. I don't want to give him any more ammunition for when Judge Grampus gets here.
Suit yourself. The bunks in the cells are probably just about as comfortable as that sofa, anyway. At least they don't have any broken springs sticking up through them.
Frank reached for a ring of keys hanging on a nail on the wall behind the desk. He unlocked the door to the cell block and put Woodford in one of the cells, all of which were empty at the moment. Woodford himself pulled the door shut.
Any coffee in the pot, Jack?
Always coffee in the pot. Question is it fit to drink?
Well, is it?
Only one way to find out. I'll get cups for both of you.
Jack brought the coffee while Frank sat down on a stool in front of the cell where Tip Woodford had lowered his bulk onto the blanket-covered bunk.
I'll go take a turn around town. The fellas coming in from the mines need to see a badge to remind them that Buckskin's a law-abiding place.
Jack went out, leaving Frank and Woodford sitting on opposite sides of the bars.
What about it, Tip? Is there any chance that Brighton is telling the truth? Is it possible he actually does own the Lucky Lizard?
I don't know, Frank. I honestly don't. I thought the deal I made with Jeremiah Fulton all those years ago was on the up and up. But I reckon it's possible Fulton lied to me. If he really was partners with Brighton's pa, and if they had a signed agreement like Brighton says, well, then, much as it pains me to say it, he might be right.
I'll have to see that document with my own eyes before I'll believe it. And even then, it's going to have to convince the judge and your lawyer, too.
What lawyer? I don't have a lawyer. Never needed one.
You do now. And you're going to have one as soon as I can get word to San Francisco. You'll have the best lawyer that the Brownin Mining Syndicate can provide for you.
I sure do appreciate the offer, Frank, but I ain't sure how that boy of yours is going to feel about it.
Let me worry about Conrad.
That evening, Frank, Conrad, and Revel were in the hotel dining room with plates of roast beef and vegetables in front of them. A short time earlier, Diana Woodford had posted bail for her father, and Frank had released Tip with a warning to go right back to the big house on the edge of town where he and Diana lived and avoid Dex Brighton.
Absolutely not. That's a private dispute between Brighton and Mr. Woodford. The Browning Mining Syndicate can't afford to become involved. If Brighton prevails in court, we would have made an enemy of him from now on.
It's a mite late to be worrying about that. Brighton already knows we don't like him.
You've already promised Mr. Woodford that we'll provide legal representation for him, haven't you?
Pretty much.
Blast it, Frank! You seem to forget that Woodford is our competition, too. We don't owe him any favors.
Garrett Claiborne is convinced that the veins of silver being mined by the Lucky Lizard and the Crown Royal don't come anywhere near each other. So it shouldn't matter to us one way or the other whether Tip's mine is successful.
That's exactly the point. It shouldn't matter to us. You offered to help him simply because he's your friend.
And what's wrong with that?
It's not good business.
There are some things more important than business.
Oh, don't say that to Conrad. He considers it heresy.
I do not. I just take a more practical approach to these matters than either of you do.
I'm not asking you or the syndicate to pay for Tip's lawyer. I figured to send for one of my personal lawyers. Turnbuckle and Stafford are already on retainer. I reckon they might as well earn some of that money I've been paying them.
Turnbuckle and Stafford are two of the top attorneys in San Francisco. In the entire country, for that matter. You dragged them out here to this frontier town for a simple mining dispute?
You gotta remember, there's a lot of money at stake here. Maybe it wouldn't be that much to hombres like Leland Stanford or J.R. Morgan or old John D. Rockefeller, but it's not a penny any poker game either. Anyway, I'm only gonna drag one of them out here from San Francisco. The other one can stay there and hold down the fort.
Hold down the fort? You refer to tending to the affairs of one of the top law firms in the country as
holding down the fort?
Call it whatever you want. I've already sent a rider to Carson City with a message to wire to San Francisco. With any luck, one of those fellas will be on a train heading in this direction before the day is over tomorrow.
I should have known there was no reasoning with you. You're as stubborn as ever.
I'd say the apple doesn't fall far from the tree.
You could at least be on my side. You're my wife, after all.
I'm always on your side, Conrad. Except when you're wrong.
I give up. I hope you two enjoy your dinner. This is liable to be the last peaceful evening in Buckskin for quite some time.
Frank couldn't argue with that. Things never seemed to stay peaceful around him for very long, no matter where he was. The next morning, Frank rode out to the Crown Royal Mine to talk to Garrett Claiborne. Stormy, the rangy gray stallion that had carried Frank over so much of the West, was clearly glad to be reunited with his master, and he stretched his legs and capered like he was a young horse again as they followed the trail out to the mine. Wolf loped alongside, occasionally dashing off to check out some intriguing scent or give chase to a rabbit or prairie dog he didn't really want to catch. He didn't go very far, though, before returning to Frank's side. Frank saw smoke rising before he reached the mine. He knew it came from the chimney of the cookhouse. Feeding a barracks full of hungry miners kept the two Mexican cooks busy most of the time. Whenever mines and railroads and all the other sorts of industry arrived, the frontier was never quite the same afterward, and for those who remembered it the way it used to be, as Frank Morgan did, there was a certain nostalgic melancholy associated with the march of progress. With each passing year, the places where a man could pause on a hilltop and watch an eagle wheeling through a pristine blue sky and know that he might well be the only human being within 100 miles were becoming fewer and fewer. Trying to stop civilization, though, or even slow it down much, was like trying to bail out the Mississippi with a tin cup. It just couldn't be done. Frank reined to a halt and swung down from the saddle in front of the log building that housed the mine superintendent's office.
Stay, Wolf.
He looped Stormy's reins around a hitching post and went up the steps to the little porch and the door. He didn't knock, but went on inside. Garrett Claiborne, who hailed from Georgia, was on the smallish side, but he was muscular and could handle himself in a fight. He had tousled dark hair and a close-cropped beard. He was standing in front of a big, angled drawing board that had a diagram of some sort pinned to it. Frank didn't know much about such things, but he thought he recognized the drawing as a cutaway diagram of the Crown Royal's network of tunnels and shafts.
Frank! I mean, Mr. Morgan!
Frank's just fine. How are you, Garrett?
Good, good.
Thinking about expanding?
Yes. I believe the vein we're following in this tunnel right here is saying out at a rate that makes extending the tunnel worthwhile. I was a little concerned about the stability of the rock strata, but I believe I've worked out some modifications to our bracing system that will alleviate the extra strain.
That's good, I reckon. Even though I barely understood what you said.
Well, don't worry. I know how you and Mr. Browning insist on proper safety procedures being followed. There's always going to be a considerable amount of risk when you're working underground, of course, but I do my best to try to minimize it. You know that most mine owners don't give much of a damn about such things?
All I know is how you run the Crown Royal, Garrett, and I'm satisfied with that.
Some of the men told me you and Mr. Browning arrived in Buckskin yesterday afternoon. If you had let me know when you were getting here, I would have ridden into town and delivered a report on the mine's operation to you both.
Time enough for that later. Anyway, it wouldn't surprise me if Conrad drove out here later today in his buggy to look the place over. You didn't get my letter telling you that we were on our way back from Arizona?
Not at all. Well, this is the first time I've heard of such a letter.
That didn't come as a surprise to Frank. He hadn't forgotten about that attempt on his life the day before. Someone hadn't wanted him to reach Buckskin alive. And the most reasonable explanation for how they had found out he was on his way was that the would-be killer, or someone he worked for, had filched that letter before Claiborne ever saw it. The question remained, though, who that might be. And even more important, who wanted Frank dead? Frank spent a while longer talking with Claiborne, then got back on Stormy and rode away from the Crown Royal. He wanted to take a better look around the site of the ambush and see if he could find anything that might give him a clue to the bushwhacker's identity. Instead of returning to the settlement and then following the road to Carson City, Frank cut across country instead. He had ridden around this region often enough so that with his frontiersman's instinct, he wasn't likely to get lost. Frank's eyes were always in motion as he rode, searching the rugged countryside around him for any sign of danger. Nothing happened, though, and he saw no sign of a trap as he approached the boulders where the riflemen had hidden. When he reached the rocks, he reined in and spent several minutes in the saddle before he dismounted, studying the area and getting the big picture set in his mind. From here, he could see all the way across the expanse of meadow where he had been riding when the shooting started. The bushwhacker had come pretty close with his bullets, but not close enough. Frank swung down from the saddle and hunkered on his heels, taking a closer look at the ground, which was hard enough so that it didn't take prints very well. He saw a few marks left by a horse's hooves, but there was nothing unusual about the prints, and no way of knowing whether they had been made by the bushwhacker's mount or the mount of some other rider. When Frank was satisfied that he wasn't going to turn up anything important, he turned to his canine friend.
Wolf, search.
The big cur started nosing through the rocks, his muzzle close to the ground. After a moment, his hackles rose, as if he smelled something he didn't like. Frank had long since learned to trust Wolf's instincts, even when they seemed almost supernatural.
Wolf, trail.
He mounted up again. Wolf took off like a shot, bounding over the ground, darting around rocks, and leaping over deadfalls. Frank followed as best he could. The trail wound back and forth, but led gradually up and over a ridge, then along a dry wash. After a half mile or so, the wash came to a creek that was flowing, the stream that had formed the wash when it was in flood. Wolf ran back and forth along the gravelly bank in frustration. Obviously, the rider he had been following had entered the creek, making it impossible for the big cur to trail him.
Let's go across and see if you can pick up the scent, big fella.
Frank sent Stormy splashing across the shallow stream. The three of them cast up and down the stream for a mile in each direction, without locating the bushwhacker's trail again.
Remember that hombre's scent, Wolf. You're liable to run across him again one of these days. And if you do, I'll be counting on you to let me know about it.
Frank supposed they might as well start back to Buckskin. He wanted to keep an eye on the situation there and make sure no more trouble broke out between Tip Woodford and Brighton. There might be other problems that needed the marshal's attention, too. And as he rode toward the settlement, he wondered if that telegram had reached the law offices of Turnbuckle and Stafford in San Francisco yet. And if it had, just what sort of reaction it had caused.
You'll be fine.
Claudius Turnbuckle wasn't really a fire-breathing dragon, but Luther Galloway felt as if he were about to enter the lair of such a mythological creature as he approached the door of Turnbuckle's private office with a yellow sealed envelope in his hand. A lad wearing the uniform of Western Union had delivered the envelope to the law offices a short time earlier and said that the envelope contained an urgent telegram. The telegram wasn't addressed to either of the partners in particular, and Luther would have much preferred dealing with Mr. Stafford, who, while pompous and stuffy, wasn't nearly as frightening as Mr. Turnbuckle. Unfortunately, Mr. Stafford was away on business for the firm, down in Los Angeles, so Luther had no choice except to rap on the heavy oak door.
What is it, dammit?
Luther turned the brass knob and eased the door open a couple of inches.
Telegram, sir. The boy who delivered it said it was urgent.
Well, bring it in!
Luther pushed the door back far enough for him to enter the dark-paneled office, with its shelves of equally dark-spined legal volumes. The lone window was covered with thick drapes. Turnbuckle sat behind a massive desk piled high with papers. Turnbuckle peered over the half-spectacles that perched on the tip of his nose and extended a big, rough hand.
Well, don't just stand there gawping, Galloway. Give it here!
Luther hurried forward and leaned over the big desk to hand the envelope to Turnbuckle. The lawyer ripped it open with long, blunt fingers and took out a yellow telegraph form. As his eyes scanned the words printed on the flimsy, those bushy eyebrows rose in surprise. Luther was equally surprised, or perhaps even more so, when a smile appeared on Turnbuckle's rugged face.
Good news, sir?
Frank Morgan needs our help.
The gunfighter, sir?
The client, whose business interests account for a significant amount of income for this firm, you mean?
Yes, sir, of course. What does Mr. Morgan want us to do for him, sir? Some business dealings that need our attention, perhaps?
Well, you could say that. He wants either me or Stafford to come to Nevada and help a friend of his defend a mining claim. Since Stafford's busy, it'll have to be me. Or rather, Us, I should say.
Nevada, sir.
That's right. Buckskin, Nevada. I know you've heard of it, Galloway. The Crown Royal Mine is located quite near there.
Yes, sir, of course. But us?
You're going with me. I'll need a clerk to handle some of the details for me, and, well, you're the most experienced one we have.
But wouldn't it be better to leave me here to make certain that the office continues functioning smoothly, sir?
The office can run itself for a while, and you damned well know it, Galloway. This is a chance to get out and see some of the country. Besides, I've always wanted to meet Frank Morgan. He's supposed to be quite an individual. Get down to the depot and purchase tickets for us on the next train to Carson City. Morgan needs us there as soon as possible. The circuit court judge is due to arrive in about a week, so we'll need time to prepare our case. Once you have the tickets, send a messenger to my house with our departure time, then go home and pack your bag.
But, sir, I can't just drop everything.
And why not? You're a single man, I believe, with no family responsibilities.
That's true, sir.
And your responsibilities at work are what I say they are. Isn't that true?
Yes, sir, certainly.
Then get cracking, son. There's no time to waste. I want to be on our way to Nevada before this day is over.
Yes, sir, of course, sir.
Like it or not, he was going to Nevada. When Dex Brighton first came to Buckskin, he had made arrangements to rent a horse from the surly proprietor of a local livery stable. Not that the man had been all that surly at first, but ever since he had found out about Brighton's claim on the Lucky Lizard, he'd been decidedly hostile, probably because he was friends with Tip Woodford. But a deal was a deal, and he hadn't tried to back out on the one he'd made with Brighton. Because of that, Brighton had a mount available whenever he needed one, a big gray gelding with white stockings and a white blaze on its face. He had ridden out to the Lucky Lizard several times to look over the mine that would soon be his. Today, though, he went the opposite way out of the settlement, heading into a rugged area where several played-out mines were still shut down. The renewed silver boom hadn't extended to them. The claims were still worthless and abandoned. No one went around them anymore. They were perfect for Brighton's purposes, in other words. He saw the outthrust sandstone brow of a ridge ahead of him and headed for it. As he drew closer, the black mouth of a mine tunnel entrance became visible at the base of the ridge under the overhang. Brighton rode right up to the tunnel and dismounted. The man who stepped out of the tunnel had a gun in his hand. He wore a black vest over a shirt that had once been white, and a black Stetson was tipped back on his head so that dark, wiry curls spilled out in front of the hat. The man's face was weathered and seamed by exposure, even though he wasn't more than 40. A misshapen lump of a nose that had been broken several times jutted out over a thick mustache and a wide, arrogant mouth. The man holstered his gun.
I thought I recognized you, boss. I wasn't going to take any chances, though.
That's good. No one knows you're here, Stample, and I want to keep it that way.
Brighton reached into the saddlebag slung over the back of the rented horse and brought out a couple of bottles of whiskey.
I figure you could use some provisions.
You do know how to take care of a fella, boss. Now, these will come in handy when the boys get here tomorrow. And that's assuming that there's any left.
I was going to ask you about that. You're still expecting the rest of the men tomorrow?
Yeah. Come on in and have a drink with me while you're here.
Brighton followed the man into the tunnel. Several crates were stacked about 20 feet inside. Brighton knew they contained food, ammunition, and other supplies. He knew that because he had paid to outfit Stample and the other men who would be showing up here soon. You had to spend money to make money, as the old saying went, and although Brighton didn't like the spending part all that much, he was willing to do it if it would help him get his hands on a fabulously valuable silver mine. It could still turn out that he wouldn't need any help from Stample and the other men he had hired if he was successful in pressuring Woodford into agreeing to a settlement. But it was better to be prepared. And he was going to get some use out of them, because he had a job that he was going to explain to Stample right now. They sat on empty crates near the remains of a campfire. Stample found some tin cups and splashed whiskey into them, then handed one to Brighton. As they sat there, Brighton heard Stample's horse moving around, deeper in the tunnel.
You've got your horse back there?
Yeah! The tunnel widens out considerable, right around that bend. Plenty of room for my horse and for the others, too, once they get here.
What about the smoke from the fire?
Got some little ventilation shafts back yonder, too. You can feel the draft from the tunnel mouth. It draws the smoke on through the tunnel, and it filters out up on top of the ridge. Nobody will notice it. Nobody will ever know we're here, boss.
That's the way I want it for now, so don't get careless. I've got a job for you.
About time.
Woodford's determined to make a court case out of this. He's going to take it before the circuit judge next week.
I thought you didn't want to go to court. You said you'd run a bluff on Woodford and make him turn over his mind to you. That phony partnership agreement you got ain't gonna stand up in court.
We don't know that. I paid good money to the man who faked it. But I'd rather not have to rely on that alone. And you're my insurance so that I won't have to, Stample.
Keep talking.
Woodford can't take the case to court if there's no judge, now can he?
You want me to kill a circuit court judge?
He'll be coming in on the stagecoach next Tuesday morning. That's the only way to reach Buckskin since there's no rail line yet. That stagecoach is going to be held up by masked outlaws, and there'll be gunplay during the robbery. Tragically, the judge will be cut down by a stray bullet.
Yeah, I can see that happening.
That will give me more time to wear down Woodford and get him to settle this without going to court. Just be sure that no one can identify you or any of the other men, and don't let them trail you back here.
Morgan never found me, did he?
And you didn't kill Morgan the way I asked you to. You missed.
Oh. I had a good bead on that son of a bitch twice. He just lucky, that's all.
I can promise you one thing. If Frank Morgan keeps sticking his nose into my business, his luck is going to run out.